647, in re CM and in re AM.
Council, before you begin, I have a couple of announcements. The first is that the Chief, Justice Delanus, is disqualified from sitting on the case. The second is, as many of you, probably all of you know, the court has opened this proceeding to the public and the media as a matter of comedy rather than an expression or proclamation of First Amendment law. The only thing that we, the court, would ask is that in the event of an inadvertent disclosure of confidential information, that it be redacted from any broadcast or publication. And that applies to you viewers looking at home as well. If anyone has any difficulty with that request, I would just ask that you leave. Having said that, counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I am here today with my co-counsel, Attorney Elliot Berry, on behalf of Larry and Sonia M. Larry is blind and disabled. Sonia has mental health problems and a limited education. Both are utterly impoverished, and they both truly love their parents. Those facts simply make them completely typical of parents involved in a neglect case. This case has already been decided. In In re Shelby R., this court held there was a due process right to appointed counsel in cases arising under RSA.
Well, two judges held that, right? Isn't that part of the rub here? Only two judges held that?
Actually, Your Honor, in reading Shelby B., although there is a dissenting opinion by Justice Duggan, in his dissent, Justice Duggan simply approaches the limited issue in Shelby of a step-parent and proposes that for step-parents, there may not be a fundamental right. However, even in his dissenting opinion, he does not question the due process rights of a natural parent.
But that's not the holding. I mean, the due process rights of a natural parent were not at issue in that case. And even though that might be sort of his dicta that he would view things that way, it's not really the holding of the case, is it?
That's correct. But neither is his dissenting opinion the holding of the case. Further, that there is no support in our jurisprudence for the notion that two out of three justices on a three-justice panel cannot make a binding decision. And this court's jurisprudence on stare decisis has been reiterated repeatedly, most recently less than 2.5 weeks ago in Ford versus DOT. This court applied a four-prong test for stare decisis. The rule in this case, that is, that there should be appointed counsel, is hardly intolerable. It is.
So your view is that a two-judge decision of a five-judge court is binding precedent?
It is, Your Honor, and I believe there is no law to the contrary in this jurisdiction.
Well, is there any law that supports that? Is there any affirmative law that says that that's the case? I mean, just as an example, it has typically been our view, I think, that we have a 3JX docket, for example. I think, and I stand to be corrected by my colleagues who have been here longer than I, that we would not decide the case on a 3JX basis if there were a dissent. We would then kick the case over to the five judges because our view would be that you need to have three judges to make a binding decision.
That may be the case. I am not
familiar that is
with the
intricacies
of the
three. That is the case. So assuming that to be the case, does it affect your analysis?
No, absolutely not, because Shelby R. was itself premised on the Matthews factors, which are set forth in our brief, and the deprivation, and there is no question in any of this court's jurisprudence that a parent has a natural and fundamental right to their relationship with their child. In fact, again, very recently in In re Haley K., this court reiterated the strong protections afforded by the New Hampshire Constitution.
Why don't you skip ahead to the distinction between an abuse and neglect proceeding and a termination of parental rights proceeding?
There is none, we would submit, Your Honor, that it is a seamless statutory web. First of all, this court has already, and again very recently, in Rena D., determined that facts adjudicated in an RSA 169C case may have a collateral estoppel effect.
Yeah, there's a little problem with that, though. If I understand it, I went back, when I read your brief, I went back and read that case. We did not address in that case, and I suspect it was because the argument was not raised, the fact of the different burden of proof between the two proceedings. In other words, to say that collateral estoppel applies to a decision made in the abuse and neglect case by a preponderance of the evidence, to say that that can foreclose the same issue in a termination case, which has to be decided beyond a reasonable doubt, I believe is contrary to, you know, a whole host of law that says that can't be the case.
I might agree with that proposition, but I don't. But I would disagree, I suppose, with my reading of Rena D. But even without Rena D, it is a seamless statute.
I don't
you're
see.
You're saying, as a practical matter, that by the time a particular situation gets to termination of parental rights, lots has happened beforehand. So I'm thinking of a hypothetical. A parent accused of abuse and neglect may have lost the child. The child is put in the state's custody for a period of time. So let's take an example of a 2-year-old who arguably has been removed from the home for up to a year before the termination proceeding starts. So for that previous year, the parent who has no counsel has to defend against all the forces of the state, against the loss of the child temporarily, albeit temporarily, now gets an attorney at the end of this seamless process, as you describe, and your argument is by then it's too late.
It is too late.
And
it's
not too only legally too late, but we have a child that's been away from a very young child, arguably, been away from the parent, and as I understand it, your concern is now we may have adoptive parents waiting in the wings, so there is this pressure, this institutional pressure, to provide what may be a great home by comparison to a not-so-great home in the face of parental fundamental rights, you argue.
Absolutely. And it's furthered by the fact that in a 169C case, when it gets to a permanency hearing, 169C23 actually shifts the burden to the parents to show when a child should be returned home. And uniquely to 169 and 170, the trial judge in a 169C case has the authority to order a party, the division, to bring a termination case. In other words, the court orders the state to bring a termination petition.
Well, let's get right to the heart of Matthews and Eldridge then. What is the risk of an erroneous deprivation if you alter what is to some evidently a paranoid view of monolithic government action to the fact that the real players on the ground are all motivated, statutorily directed to consider what's in the best interest of the child?
They are directed to do so. But people
can. Do you have any evidence they don't?
None. But a parent is at such an enormous disadvantage. First of all, at the very.
Even with procedural due process concepts, if you're familiar with them, I'm sure you are.
Very. But a parent is not protected without counsel.
Well, I mean, it strikes me that I read the briefs and I read all the sort of, you know, the list of sort of horribles that can happen, and I don't have any question that there may be cases in which that's true. But having sat on a number of these cases, it strikes me that, you know, most of them are not of that variety. It's a pretty straightforward issue. It's not one that there are usually sort of really sophisticated expert witnesses are coming in. It seems that the mine run of those cases are not of the kind that that are likely to overwhelm somebody.
I would disagree, Your Honor. First of all, even the definition of neglect is a legal definition.
No, statutory,
not a practical,
sure.
Not an everyday, ordinary English one.
But I suppose at the bottom, I'm thinking about this, that the heart of your argument is this. In our society, we guarantee individuals accused of crimes counsel if they cannot afford counsel. So an individual who's charged with misdemeanor shoplifting gets a lawyer. A parent who is facing loss of the custody of her child doesn't get counsel.
That's correct. And the issues in that, in a minor misdemeanor case, are far simpler. Shoplifting, everybody understands. While Justice Lynn is correct that some of the cases are relatively straightforward at an adjudicatory phase, when we are dealing with dispositional orders, we are often dealing with lengthy psychological reports, skilled social workers, and at every review hearing, there are terms that are purely terms of law. They're acronyms, APLA.
So would you be satisfied that the Matthews-Eldridge analysis requires counsel at the dispositional phase only?
No. It requires it completely through the proceeding because these cases, unlike even delinquency cases, the dispositional orders can change at a review hearing.
Enlighten me more about the risk of an erroneous deprivation.
The risk is enormous. The parent is confronted with, in very little time, having to try a case. The length of time between the bringing of a petition and an adjudication is set by statute at 30 days. However, the preliminary hearing may not be held until day 7 or day 8. There's 22 days left.
You're talking about the district court proceeding at this point?
Correct. Even for a lawyer, if they were appointed at the preliminary hearing, as had been the law, it's 22 days to obtain discovery, to learn what the case is about, to obtain witnesses, and to try a case. If the appointment of counsel is delayed, that time becomes almost meaningless. The evidence is often written by social workers. It's written at an advanced level, and parents do not understand it, and they certainly don't understand that they have the burden of proving that they are fit to be reunified with their
children. Am I correct that New Hampshire, after 30 years of appointing counsel to these people, that New Hampshire is the only state that has reversed this provision of counsel?
It is the only state that has reversed it and is one of only two states now that does not provide for counsel at all, the other being the state of Mississippi. The risk is enormous. The division is represented by an attorney. If we read the recent decision from the Supreme Court of Massachusetts in adoption of Megan, that court held an indigent parent facing the possible loss of a child cannot be said to have a meaningful right to be heard in a contested proceeding without the assistance of counsel. Provision of appointed counsel not only safeguards the right of the parents, but assists the court in reaching its decision with the utmost care and an extra measure of evidentiary protection required by law. These considerations may be more apparent in cases where the petitioner seeking the termination is the state, which is not only represented by counsel, but has superior resources. And there is a deprivation in an RSA 169C case.
Won't you now move to the other elephant in the room, which is whether there should be a blanket due process, substantive due process right in all cases to counsel versus there should be a right within the discretion of the trial court in an appropriate, for lack of a better word, in the appropriate case.
Cases under 169C or terminations are different if there is actual state action involved. We have a state actor in these cases.
Facts are different in all of them, though, you agree, even though your cookie-cutter factual outlay was accurate.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. I thought you were talking about whether we should provide counsel in divorce cases.
No, I must have misspoken. I was talking about the argument that's the thread that's in this case where someone is arguing, maybe no one is, that there should not be a blanket substantive right to counsel, but it should be made on a case-by-case determination.
And under the statute, that's made at the preliminary hearing, isn't it?
It is made at the preliminary hearing. It is practically impossible to do a case-by-case analysis because an inquiry would have to be made at a preliminary hearing, remembering that we're at day 7 or day 8 of a 30-day clock. If the court has to make an inquiry at that point and come up with whatever factors may be relevant, then find an attorney, then appoint him or her.
So the unrepresented person would have to present to the court extraordinary circumstances and may not appreciate what the entire process is going to be going down the line.
Correct. Nor can the court necessarily know what disabilities or limitations a person has. And the preliminary hearing is a critical step. At a preliminary hearing, it is the opportunity of a parent to perhaps dismiss a petition for being legally insufficient, which has happened before. And it is their opportunity, if there's been an ex parte removal of a child, to address the necessity for an ex parte removal.
And Superior Court review is de novo as well, correct?
The Superior Court review is de novo, but after disposition, and is not even known to most parents. It would be known to counsel, certainly. But it is de novo, and it is after the dispositional phase. And by that point, if a child...
I don't mean to pick a fight with you, but it must say on the dispositional form that you have a right to a de novo review by filing in Superior Court within 30 days.
Actually, I don't believe it does on the forms used by the court system.
Would you fix that for me?
I'm not sure I have the authority.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Before you sit down, Attorney Sklar, you didn't introduce yourself, and I know for the record we require it. So you are Attorney Sklar.
I am, and I'm terribly sorry. I introduced Attorney Barry.
Thank you, counsel.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Jean Herrick, and I represent DCYF in this matter.
Could you pull that microphone closer? Thank you.
Sure. There's no dispute that there is no per se right to appointed counsel in an abuse or neglect proceeding under the federal constitution.
The argument here has only been under the state constitution, though, as I understand.
I think it's both.
Actually, both questions are raised.
I had understood the parent's brief to be limited to the state constitution. At the appellate level, I thought they waived under the federal. Okay.
That's correct. And the reason why they waived is that there's just no question that there is no per se right. So the question really here is whether or not there is a per se right to appointed counsel under the New Hampshire Constitution. Except for Shelby R., there is consistency among the precedent where custody of a child is at stake. The right to counsel and other procedural protections afforded criminal defendants, such as the right to be physically present, which was decided in Rodney P., and the preponderance of the evidence standard, which was decided in Tracy M.
Let's just assume for argument that you're right. There's no precedent that establishes this right. Why is this case not the opportunity for us to recognize such a right?
This case is the opportunity to recognize that there would be a per se right, because this case doesn't have any unusual circumstances. What this case demonstrates, though, is that there should not be a per se right. There are no issues in this case that are raised other than very general issues about the care of the children, whether or not the house is kept in a clean manner, whether the children are properly watched by their parents.
But often, while that is happening, the child is not in the home, right?
That's true.
And the clock ticks from a child's standpoint, each day, each week, each month can have dramatic consequences. I understand your argument legally, but I'm looking at the impact on the child, which does relate to the best interest of the child. So if we take an example of a child being removed from the home based on allegations of abuse and neglect, it's conceivable that child is out of home for a year. And if the child is 2 years old, 3 years old, 4 years old, that is an amount of time that can be life-changing, can it not?
That's true. But this court already decided in Brittany S., that once the custody was taken away from the parent, that in those proceedings that followed, in the post-dispositional phase proceedings, that there is no right to counsel. And that case involved issues that had to do with medical evidence. The mother in that case had bipolar disorder. the court had an issue with respect to reviewing medical records of the mother.
Let me shift gears. From the court's standpoint, based on my 17 years on the trial bench, it was a heck of a lot easier for me to deal with cases where there are counsel on both sides, because I know that I'm going to be given as much information as the attorneys can get to me to make these very important decisions. So the trial court, in essence, gets handicapped in its decision to make what is going to be in the best interest of the child, the paramount standard, if it is dealing with an unrepresented person who is struggling to understand the process, which can be, notwithstanding, a run-of-the-mill. You said in your brief this was a run-of-the-mill case.
Sorry about that.
For that parent, it's not run-of-the-mill. It is life-altering. And I'm not being critical of you.
I understand that. The problem is that the Constitution does not require judicial efficiency. The Constitution requires fundamental fairness. And in order to assure that there is some judicial efficiency in this process, the court has adopted protocols in child abuse and neglect cases. The court has adopted a process already whereby there's a colloquy between the parent and the judge to make sure that the parent at that initial hearing understands the potential consequences.
I've had difficulty explaining process to first-year law students, and I know how difficult it is for a trial judge to explain to parties, well, now this is your burden. Go to it. You're on.
I would suggest that equally difficult to understand is our landlord-tenant statute. That statute is difficult to understand. There are very specific procedural hoops that have to be jumped through. There is a very quick timeline that the tenant has to show up and address the issues, and we don't require appointed counsel there.
Let me ask you this. Given the fact that for 30 years, approximately, New Hampshire has provided counsel to indigent parents, and now the spigot's been shut, to what extent should we consider that 30-year precedent, if you will, in analyzing this case? Clearly, our legislature recognized the importance for 30 years. Has it become less important because it costs approximately $1 million a year?
The recognition that we need to give it is that was a policy choice of the legislature. The Constitution.
Of course, if the legislature wanted it to be, thought it should be a constitutional right, they, of course, could have proposed a constitutional amendment to guarantee that right.
They could do that.
As opposed to having us sort of interpret the Constitution into the creation of that right.
If it were the case that people had planned their affairs based on the understanding that there would be a constitutional right to counsel in abuse and neglect cases, then maybe that would be significant. But these are not the kinds of cases. This is not where, like a case that would have to do with wills or some other area where people plan their affairs around what the legislature has decided.
Well, walk us through the Matthews-Eldridge analysis. I mean, this is obviously satisfies prong number one.
That's correct. And what we need to do is, once we figure out what prong number one is, which is the interest at stake, then we have to focus on the nature of the proceedings. And the interest at stake doesn't migrate into the nature of the proceedings. These proceedings, and this court has held in every case that it has looked at with respect to these proceedings, that they actually increase or decrease the risk of erroneous deprivation. They are informal proceedings. Parents do not have to worry, as they do in other states, about whether or not the allegations could form the basis of a criminal charge, because our statute provides for immunity for testimony in the proceedings. So that's not at issue here. The testimony comes in so far as it's relevant and material. The proceedings themselves, as I'm sure you are aware, are very informal already. Much like other circuit court proceedings, they're very informal. The testimony is allowed oftentimes in the form of a narrative. So there's not the technical rules that require a litigant to have to understand
what
how to
the
pose
risk
questions.
Of an erroneous, or are you answering my question? What about the risk of an erroneous deprivation? Is that what you're answering now?
The risk, well, all of those lower the risk of an erroneous deprivation that, because whatever form.
That's what's fascinating, because you argue in your brief that because the rules of evidence don't apply, that benefits the parents. Your opponent argues because the rules of evidence don't apply, the parents are handicapped because all kinds of hearsay comes in and they don't have the background and the experience to know how to attack all of that hearsay, because frankly, in most of the reports, it's all hearsay, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that is the ironic thing about this, because the very protection you're arguing, they're saying, is precisely the handicap that the parents have.
And Lassiter addressed that issue. And essentially, the fact that an attorney dealing with hearsay coming in might do a better job and might be more adept at limiting what comes in and how it comes in, the fact that it comes in, it doesn't become fundamentally unfair until the fact that that kind of testimony comes in raises the threshold of the risk to such a heightened level. And there is no court, there are no cases cited by any party that would suggest that a lower technical burden has ever raised the risk of an erroneous deprivation. In fact, all of the cases say that as we lower the technical burdens, that pro se litigants are in a better shape in getting a better outcome. So that argument, I think, is unique in this case.
I guess I'm wondering what you alluded before to the landlord-tenant circumstance. And I guess what I'm kind of wondering here is if we're being asked to basically create a new entitlement for parents in this kind of situation because of the importance of the issue. I guess I'm wondering if we were to do that, what are the limiting principles? I mean, why isn't it that somebody that's faced with the state in state-sponsored housing of some kind, or that somebody that, you know, lives in the North Country and is dependent on a car because there's no public transportation is going to lose his driver's license? What about that person and therefore lose the ability to support his family and maybe, that results in the child being taken away? I guess I'm really concerned about where are the limiting principles if we recognize this new right.
And that's the problem with this case, because the interest, as we discussed earlier, at stake is the right to the custody and control of your child. There are a number of other statutes where a parent's right to the custody and control of their child is at stake. The biggest one that shows up most in the courts in New Hampshire is in a divorce proceeding. In divorce proceedings, we often have cases where there is one side represented by counsel and the other side is not.
The combatants, so to speak, are the parents themselves. Here, one combatant is the unrepresented parent, and the other is the state with all of its resources. To my mind, that is qualitatively different.
I have two responses to that. One is, first, due process arises because of the interest at stake. So it doesn't matter whether it's a state who seeks to take custody of the child or whether it is a private party, as the Adoption and Megan case mentions, where a private party seeks to terminate a parent's right through an adoption or some other proceeding, which you can under statutes in New Hampshire, then the rights at stake for that parent are the same. And the state has created the mechanism for that to happen. And in divorce proceedings, it's the same. The state has created the mechanism for a court to issue an order that tells a parent to stay away from their own child in a divorce proceeding. And so due process engages in a divorce proceeding. The second thing is that certainly there can be an imbalance in resources between parents or between litigants in a divorce proceeding, especially litigants perhaps who are not married and there's not common property. And the notion that all of the resources of the state are against a litigant in an abuse and neglect proceeding is contrary to the very purpose of the statute. In fact, the resources of the state in an abuse and neglect proceeding are in favor of reuniting that child with those parents. There are social workers who are hired by the state of New Hampshire to assist parents and to develop plans to get that child back reunited with those parents. Of the 900 cases that are filed in abuse and neglect proceedings, 85 of them do not result in a termination, 85% do not result in a termination of parental rights case. And so the resources, that's a demonstration that these resources are intended, it's not against the parent. And looking at it in that framework is wrong. In a termination proceeding, they are. Once we initiate a termination proceeding, then the resources of the state are seeking to terminate that parent's rights.
But we can't look at a termination proceeding in a vacuum. It frequently is preceded by a year-long abuse and neglect case, sometimes longer than that. And that's my worry here. We're going to parachute an attorney into the termination case, and that attorney has to live with everything that happened during the abuse and neglect case when that parent had no counsel. And I submit that even the most talented attorney may have some handicaps doing that.
Unfortunately, there are also criminal defense attorneys that are faced with that same problem, because we sentence criminal defendants to probation and other conditional sentences, and we send them out to work with a probation or parole officer. And that attorney does not get to hold the hand of that criminal defendant through that process. And that's exactly what's being argued here, is that that attorney is necessary to hold one hand while the social worker holds the other hand in order for us to get a just result.
Well, I think the real sense of the argument is that the process, and fortunately or unfortunately, the three of us have done it hundreds of times, that the process is so seamless that, in essence, once you begin, be it district court or superior court de novo, you've already reached the end. How do you respond to that?
Because in order to proceed to a termination proceeding, a new petition must be filed. And to address the Michael E. issue that Judge Lynn was talking about earlier with the collateral effect, it's it's not a collateral estoppel principle. What it is that what Michael E. says is that the parents are precluded from collaterally attacking the validity of the abuse and neglect finding in a termination proceeding, which is different than collateral estoppel. No further questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sklar, did you retain any time?
I did not, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you. Case submitted. Thank you all, and thank you particularly to those of you in the gallery for keeping your promise.